Okay, our second speaker today is Will Prentice. He's originally from Scotland and moved to the south of England to study music. And after completing a master's degree in ethnomusicology at Goldsmith College in London, he was hired by the British Library Sound Archive to digitize their collection of 3,000 ethnographic brown wax cylinders. Project took 18 months, and then he stayed on at the Sound Archive as an audio engineer, where he's been for 5 years. He's had long-standing interest in discography, and his current research began with a collection of around 50 78s he came across in the Sound Archive that had never been fully cataloged. He's interested in exploring different ways in which archival holdings can be useful to researchers, and finding out what discographical information can tell us beyond the bare details of where and when a recording was issued. So welcome, Will Prentice.
Thank you. Just waiting for the screen to come on. It's a slightly grand title I'm a bit nervous about now, Social History Through Discography. It's essentially I'm just trying to contextualize early recordings, basically, and I think I don't need to convince anybody of the value in doing that. So, as you just heard, I discovered... are we on? Nearly? I discovered a stack of shellac discs, and the further I investigated into the history of them, the more places I poked my nose in, the more doors seemed to open to me. I discovered these are produced by the Gramophone Company, which later became EMI. I was lucky to get into the EMI archive. I discovered complete lists of the recordings as written by the recording engineers, catalogues from the time they were produced, artist contracts, photographs, and company correspondence. As well as the EMI and other archives in the UK, I discovered, I got a grant from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust in the year 2000 to travel to Central Asia and the Caucasus for 2 months to visit archives from that time. Sorry, should I be closer? Is that better? Okay. Okay. Marvelous. Okay, so there are two main aims to the paper. First, I want to learn something of the circumstances in which the recordings were made, including the company methodology in the region. And second of all, trying to uncover something of life in the region at the time beyond what the music sounded like, to see if we can extrapolate any further information from the surrounding data. So first of all, this is a brief look at what the region looks like geographically. It's kind of shimmering there. It's obviously hot there this time of year. You'll notice the Caspian Sea in the middle. Can you read the writing on it?
Yes.
Okay, good. The Caspian Sea, this is where Europe and Asia collide, basically. The Caspian, to the left of the Caspian Sea, you have Caucasia, which was known as Caucasia, Transcaucasia at the time. To the right of it, you have Russian Turkestan, which is now Central Asia, we think of it as. The dotted line on the map represents the railway lines that existed at the time, which is relevant, as we'll see in a second. This is a close-up of the Caucasus. Today, this area is basically Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan, plus the North Caucasus mountain republics, such as Chechnya and a great many others. But at this time, it was we're talking the first couple of decades of the 20th century. It was one province within the pre-Soviet Russian Empire. The capital of the region was Tiflis, which you can see roughly in the middle, which is now Tbilisi in the Republic of Georgia. That was where the Gramophone based its branch for the whole Caucasus and Central Asian region. This is the Russian Turkestan side. This area is now known as the Five Stans. I don't know how many of you could name the Five Stans. Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan. At this time, they were largely... It was open territory inhabited by nomadic tribesmen. It was mostly a desert with a few oasis towns. There were two kingdoms. You can see Hiva there, just below the Aral Sea, and down a bit is the Kingdom of Bukhara, or the Emirate of Bukhara. Also, just north of there on the east is Tashkent, which was the Russian center, the administrative center of the area at the time. So what was company policy? What were they doing there and why? Basically, they were claiming territory, as many gramophone companies did in the early days, and as many dot-com companies did in that particular boom as well. The gramophone company formed in London in 1902. It spread like a successful disease throughout Europe very quickly, reaching Russia in 1900. And it certainly by 1902, or perhaps a little later, they opened an agency working on their behalf in Tiflis. By 1908, that agency had been replaced by a company-owned branch, which covered the whole area. The image you're looking at here was the gramophone company shop and headquarters on the main street in Tiflis. It's a very evocative picture. It was actually published in a catalogue at the time. This is the interior of the shop. It's clearly warm there as well. As well as the gramophone horns around you, and you can see the catalogues on the table, you have these pigeonholes on the wall. There are about 900 visible in the picture, and there may have been more. So if each one represents a different title, that's a lot of material available there. The gentleman third from the right is an Englishman, Fred Tyler, who was the company manager, branch manager for the region from 1910 up until 1915, when the advancing German army meant he had to leave in a hurry. This is an image of, in the middle we have Fred Tyler, again, the branch manager. To his right is Edmund Pierce, an Englishman who was the recording engineer who made the recording trips there between 1910 and 1914. Gentleman to the left is unknown, is clearly a perhaps a local agent, I'm not sure. This was taken in Tashkent. The company made, between 1902 and 1915, they made 11 recording trips in the region. They recorded more than 4,000 sides. This is big business, and it was punishing stuff. These were, we'll talk a bit more about the physical journeys they made. Once the wax blanks had been recorded, they were sent back to Hanover in Germany, where test pressings were made. Company from them decided what was to be released. The discs were then pressed in Riga, the factory, from 1903 onwards. The company printed catalogues locally and wholesaled discs from Tiflis and other regional agencies, which progressively appeared throughout the period of the company. Before we go on, I'd like to play you three brief examples. These are all from the Caucasus. They're very brief examples, and they're most likely very unfamiliar stylistically to most of you. So I hope that they will convey something of the power and the artistry in this music, because it's really amazing stuff. First of all, a choir from Ingushetia. Ingushetia is a small republic just next door to Chechnya. This choir was led by Arslan Bek Saltiev, who I'm guessing is the gentleman holding the dagger, as opposed to the other men who are merely wearing them. How was that level wise? Does that sound okay?
Too loud.
Too loud? You're my friends. Compromise. Okay. Next, an artist from present day Azerbaijan, Jabar Karayagdi, is to this day a legendary figure, an amazing singer. Azeri singers are often compared positively to nightingales. You might get an idea of what that's about when you hear this small clip. It's from towards the end of a side he recorded in 1909. Next we have Bagrat. He was, like Karayagdev, he was enormously popular in his lifetime, but unlike him, he's unknown today. He's an Armenian musician who performed in three different languages fluently. He performed in Georgian, Armenian, and Azeri languages. This is an Armenian song. He's accompanied by two duduks. A duduk is essentially an oboe. If there's time at the end, there's one other example I'd like to play, but we'll see how we do. So let's take a look at how the company methods and recording process itself influenced the final product. We're going to look at it in three areas: the selection of the recording locations, the selection of artists and repertoire, and thirdly, the subsequent selection of recordings to be released. So this is the map we saw before. As regards selecting the recording locations, well, first of all, they followed the railway. You can see that in the Caucasus, the railway comes down to Vladikavkaz, and then because of the mountains, there's no railway link to Tiflis, so they had to travel by horse and cart over the mountains, carrying these wax blanks and their very fragile machinery. Then traveled basically eastwards from Tiflis across the Caspian Sea as far as Tashkent and the smaller towns there. That's a journey of about 2,000 miles, mostly through desert. How do you keep a wax disc cool in a desert? In a horse and cart or a train carriage. And then, of course, because the railway's a dead end, they had to go back the same way. Certainly to begin with, the recording experts followed the railway. They stuck to the larger towns. There was, however, an expansion program, there's a good example of that in a letter written by Fred Tyler, the manager, back to the London head office in 1911. He says, "Perhaps the greatest increase can be looked for in the Trans-Caspian territory, i.e. Russian Turkestan, which is a comparatively new field for the gramophone business and where there are yet to be tapped several large and more or less populous districts lying wide of the railway line. To open up these districts, I have made arrangements with a representative in Tashkent to send out his native assistant with a supply of motors and records carried on horses or donkeys. He is instructed to give a concert in each town or village and afterwards to sell his stock as may be possible or take orders. I have great hopes that this will lead to a considerable addition in the business, as there is a wide field lying beyond Tashkent to the borders of Western China, which has so far been untouched." That process did go ahead, and in fact, immediately after that letter was sent, the following recording trip, they did send a recording expert into that region, wide of the railway, and recorded quite extensively, and then a catalogue was issued dedicated to that region. Selection of artists and repertoire. Well, first of all, the local agents had a big hand in that. They had local knowledge of who was worth recording, and they had a financial interest in getting the good guys. The company themselves had very limited knowledge of local music culture, and being citizens of an European empire, they had precious little interest in the culture of the places they were trying to dominate. So they applied their own criteria to the to try and make decisions as to what would be recorded and what shouldn't be recorded. First thing to note is that this area is enormous. It's I'm afraid it's actually bigger than Texas. And it's ethnically very diverse. In the North Caucasus alone, the area around Vladikavkaz, there are presently between, I think, 50 and 70 completely distinct languages spoken. And at this time, there were many more. And in the whole area, you're talking well over 100 languages spoken. Many different religions, different musical practices, different cultural everything. So they had a bewildering area to deal with. And even if they did want to tackle this and become culturally immersed, then it would take several lifetimes to really know what was going on. But here's a clue as to how they handled it. Fred Tyler wrote a memoir sometime after the Second World War talking about how what they were doing there. And he stated that the company's aim was, quote, to build up a satisfactory repertoire of representative records which could satisfy such a wide market, and that records were made of nearly all dialects and representative instruments. So in lieu of any knowledge as to what was going on culturally, they stuck to the objective, externally visible things, different languages, different instruments, and on the rare occasions when an artist told them what genre they were performing in, that would be noted down as part of the song title and would appear in the label, and that was then used as well. This approach seems to have been quite common at the time, and here's a quote from a letter sent by Will Geisberg, who was in London at the time, to all his branch managers throughout Europe and elsewhere. He says, this is 1911, "Dear sirs, we are endeavoring to collect information for the Victor Talking Machine Company, who are compiling a continental catalogue for use in America. This, as you will realize, means that a larger number of our matrices will be issued in America. The Victor Company, therefore, wish a very exhaustive and comprehensive list, giving the different languages and dialects in which each of our branches has recorded, and also the dialects which have not been recorded. They want even further to know the character and the locality where such languages or dialects are to be found." So they were thinking in the same way, it seems. They compartmentalized the world on the similar dimensions. The company also had technical considerations, of course. This was the acoustic era. Certain instruments just couldn't really be recorded effectively. For example, in present-day Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, they have long-standing jaw harp traditions. Well, there are none of those on the acoustic recordings, funnily enough. The artist, of course, had a great say in what repertoire was recorded, depending on what he knew, what he was willing to play. And it's important to remember also that many artists, important artists, specifically important artists, weren't willing to perform. They felt that they had a tight rein on the goods that they were selling. Every time somebody went to hear them, they had to be there and they had to be paid. As soon as they made a record, almost certainly for a one-off payment, it meant that anybody could hear them at any time, as many times as they want, for free. Well, if I was a musician, then I would think twice, too, about being recorded, probably. So here's a company label from the time. This is a Chechen dance record. You'll notice it's written in three languages. In fact, in this case, three alphabets. It's the generic company information is in English, mostly at the top. And also it says, just to the left of the whole, it says Chechenian, meaning Chechen. The title, and then lower, the artist are written in Russian, and this is always the case. But just above, in between there, you have the indigenous language spot. So in this case, Chechens being Islamic, the information was written in the Arabic script in this case. The selection of the recordings to be released was down to the company, obviously. They did so largely on technical quality rather than artistic quality. It seems that they had no real mechanism for deciding what was a good recording, what was a bad one. You'd think that when the test pressings came back to the office, they would play them to somebody who knew, and that must have happened to some degree, but we have enough examples of frankly appalling records from the region. And I know that that's a contentious thing to say, because of course present-day taste is not the same as taste at the time, but take, for example, of an accordionist playing a dance tune, which consists of a single repeated motive. It's a 10-inch side. He plays for about 2 minutes, then just dwindles away, thinking it's probably time to stop now, and then just dies out. And then someone shouts, seemingly quite angrily, in a language I don't know, in the background, and he starts the same riff again, and goes on till the end. And they issued this. I mean, you'd think perhaps they didn't even listen to the test pressing all the way through. I don't know what happened. Certainly, as many of you will know, at the time, at this time, there was no way of playing sides back in the field. The only way they could judge them was visually. When these recording experts were judging, they were staring like hawks at the cutter. And we have quite a lot of documentation about horror stories from the one engineer to another saying, "I can't believe you got that batch completely bad." You do a couple, and then you look at it, and you know, how didn't you know? So the company also knew, I mean, they were businessmen, they were good businessmen. They understood about perceived demand for artist or instrument or language or occasionally genre. So they weren't completely operating in a vacuum. Ethnographically, what can we learn from any of this? Well, taking the whole body of 4,000 recordings as a whole, we know that it's not necessarily an accurate reflection of local musical culture because of the partial geographical coverage. If you're wondering, if somebody was wondering why there weren't many rural or remote or nomadic musicians recorded, well, it's not because there weren't many necessarily, it's because they never met up with the recording engineers, similar to the rural blues recordings in America, I imagine, a similar situation. Also, the company's pattern of expansion was halted very suddenly, and they were expanding really rapidly. It was a very successful operation. It's also very hard to judge performance standards. The performance quality, as I've explained, was not always guaranteed. However, the surviving data is useful. Looking through the recording logs compiled by the recording engineers and the catalogs of the sites which were finally published, we get a great idea of repertoire and repertoire distribution. You could almost draw a map of what was popular where to some degree. Popular not necessarily for the record buying public because we don't see that from the catalog, but popular from a musician's point of view. And you get an idea of relative popularity as well. The label colors, as is common with almost everything in Britain, there was and usually is a hierarchy. The brown label you saw was for the common or garden artists. There was a black label for the more prestigious artists. And for one artist only, the court musician of the Emir of Bukhara, there was a yellow label. His name was Levi Babakhanov, a very famous musician to this day. That gives us an idea of the relative artist status. And the languages that were recorded in, the catalogues and the other data give us a really, to me, fascinating and tantalising glimpse into the inter-ethnic relations of the time. And it's something that's not well documented historically. So, for example, in Tiflis, in the capital, which is a very cosmopolitan, multicultural city, Georgian and Armenian and Azeri singers tended to perform in their own languages. Whereas many Armenian singers, were multilingual in their performance. They not only performed in different languages, but in different styles. One of my favorite examples is Bagrat, the musician you saw earlier, an Armenian musician performing an Azeri tune in the Georgian language. So, great. And this is also contradicted today, largely. After 70 years of Soviet revisionism, where these nations were divided up and they were given new histories, effectively, sifting out the multiculturalism of the past. People like Jabar Karayagdi, the Azeri musician I played you, because he played only Azeri music, he's seen as a beacon of Azeri culture, whereas Bagrat, nobody knows him today because he's not a nice, tidy Armenian, I think. I played some recordings of him to some eminent scholars, musicologists in Yerevan in Armenia, and they said, well, never heard of him, and he's not any good really, is he? I said, well, he was really popular at the time. You know, he was considered good, and they said, yeah, well, there's lots of popular musicians who are terrible. In Vladikavkaz, the mountain region, one of the reasons there's so many language and disparate cultures there is that it's a particularly complicated mountain situation. People live in very isolated valleys. But one accordionist in 1909 recorded the music of seven different cultures, just the one man. And he also recorded a polka. So maybe that's from the polka people of the Northern Caucasus. This is, just in passing, this is a 1909 catalog cover from the Caucasus with a Georgian woman dancing to the gramophone, you can see. So it's the typical advert for why these things are good for you. This is the Turkestan equivalent. What's interesting about this one is that each, as far as I can make out, each gentleman there represents a different tribe or ethnic group. So that the man sitting in the middle with a white turban I know is from Bukhara. The man immediately to his left with the woolly black hat is from Turkmenistan. So it's something of a kind of gathering of the peoples all to admire this wonderful new gramophone. Company correspondence is fascinating too. We know from that there was a steady stream of Indian records being shipped to this region. Why were they listening to Indian records? It's fascinating. There were a tiny Hindustani population in the city of Bukhara. They were tradesmen, and it may have been that it was going to them, but we also know further south in Afghanistan, there was a big Indian influence on the music. In the late 19th century, the king of Afghanistan, a big fan of music, imported a set of musicians to his court, and they had a widespread influence on Afghanistan music, which can be heard today, both in the music itself and in the instruments and in the language used to describe the music. So maybe this is some spin-off on that, and it would be great to somehow chart the movement of influence in that, but I don't know that we can ever do that. Here's another little quote which gives a glimpse into what the recording engineers experienced from the company correspondence. Edmund Pierce, the recordist in 1911 from Bukhara, having just finished in Samarkand, wrote the following to head office. In Samarkand, we made some records of harem women, a thing that has never been done before. We had to take the machine to the house of the chief magistrate and set it up there, who thereupon brought forth the women and gave them permission to uncover themselves. And he notes in brackets, only their faces, however. It was quite romantic, especially as it had to be done after 10 o'clock at night. So we have no sales statistics, unfortunately. I think that's the missing link, really, because we can gauge relative popularity from how often people were recorded, from their contracts, how much they were offered, the fact that they were offered exclusive contracts, but we don't know enough about sales, and that's a big a gap. The recordings also add detail to some aspects of history that we already know something about. So that the Bukharan court system, I mentioned Levi Babakhanov, he was the emir's musician. The emir didn't want Levi Babakhanov to record, but somehow he was persuaded. And he did so on the proviso that the company also recorded his brass band. He had a band of Western instruments who apparently performed on horseback, performed Sousa marches, etc., and other European music. And there are two accounts as to this band, and both accounts say that they were appalling. In the company memoir, it states that that the recording, the memoir of the branch manager who did the negotiation, but he said, we made the recordings to satisfy the emir, and we put them in a presentation album for him, gave them to him, and we never issued them. There was no point. Well, he did. He issued six sides. So, you know, maybe they were worth something. Sadly, I haven't heard any. The harem women were recorded from the Bukharan court, and also Bacha boy. Does anyone know what a Bacha boy is? Well, that's a shame. Bacha. I was hoping not to have to explain what a bacha boy is. Bacha boys were largely effeminate-looking young boys who danced and sang and provided other services to the great and the good of Bukhara. Well, there are some photographs taken by the recording engineers of them, and I think almost two dozen recordings of a group of three bacha boys of their repertoire, which I think is absolutely fascinating. Other small snippets, very briefly, a Kazakh comic, a comedian, was recorded. It was songs, but humorous songs. And what a great way to find out something of the local culture, to know what their humor, what was funny at the time. Very briefly, I want to show you two images to close, just because I want to share these with you. This is a great picture. It's not the gramophone company. It was a Polish company called Sport Record. Shipped a bunch of Azeri and Armenian musicians to Warsaw in 1913 to record a whole batch of material. In the middle row, you have the four singers all competing to out-regal the others. They're very dignified, and all of them are today recognized as fine singers. And the two accompanists are at the bottom. That's just a terrific picture. And this is a kind of local take on the dog. Which I like very much. How are we for time?
Five minutes.
Including questions?
Okay,
I'll play you one. Just to close, I'll play you one final example. The other examples were from the Caucasus. This final one is from Turkestan, from very near the Chinese border. It's a male vocal trio. Where's my mouse? They're not the Bee Gees, but they have something in common with the Bee Gees. This takes your ears a while to adjust to, but believe me, it's powerful stuff.
Oh,
I hope I didn't sound condescending about that, because I think it is really powerful stuff. And if you hear the full side, then you really get the impact of it. And it's really heartfelt stuff. Okay, does anyone have any questions? Chris.
I know you don't have any sales figures, but do you have any clue as to what percentage of the population in these regions could afford this kind of machine? And of course,
very small. We know that from some of the most prestigious artists, a letter was sent back after they were signed to the company, a very excited letter saying, we got these two big guys. And it says how much they signed them for and how much they expected to have to pay them in royalties. And from that, we get an idea that they were talking of tens of thousands of sales per year for these big artists. And I think from subsequent information, I think they actually didn't achieve those sales. I think they priced them out of the market. They put them on this yellow label, and it was too expensive for the local population. But in most cases, significantly less than that. It's very hard to say because the Caucasus is a more European culture. The Central Asian side was at that time less materialistic, a far higher percentage of nomads, and so less integration with. I think this is very much a kind of European sedentary lifestyle pastime, and I think the answer is a very small percentage, but it was growing very largely at the time the war wiped the whole operation out.
Well, there's so much paperwork, apparently, that the EMI archives have saved. How well have they done with masters or copies?
Of discs? I think, well, it's with this operation, it's very hard for me to know. I was very privileged to go there to rake through the stuff, or to ask them to see stuff. And they have so much information that I could only scrape along the surface. I know that they did preserve metal masters largely up until the 1930s. I think they probably still have a great deal of them, but the ones I looked up in the progress books, it shows, that a lot of them were destroyed in the 30s to recycle the materials. Other ones from the catalogues that they had a use for, I mean, they had no use for this catalogue in the 30s. They could never sell it back to the Soviets. So. Other stuff I suspect they have a lot of. I know they do have an enormous disc archive of acoustic era shellac, so I think there's a lot in there, but as to how anyone ever finds out, because they don't have it electronically catalogued, I don't really know how we find out. Sorry, up at the back?
Yeah, what's the name of that Polish label?
Sport Record. SP, well, it was written in a Cyrillic alphabet, but it would be transliterated as SPORT and then a dash. RECORD, and I think they were related to Stella Record, because I don't know how you go back in these things. You can just see the poster in the background. It says Stella Concert Record on the poster, so perhaps it was the same company, different brands from the same studio or something. On the front page. Yeah, that's right. It's only in the Arabic script. You can see the British, the Latin script logo on the company below that. Inside it was bilingual, at least bilingual. Everything was written in Russian, and then each individual title and artist was written in whatever the indigenous alphabet was. Yep.
In one of the Oakwood Trilogy movies, they showed someone just taking photographs and selling tickets to go just look at photographs of famous places.
I haven't heard any evidence, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if that did happen. I mean, there was the thing of giving concerts from the back of a donkey. That that was to drum up business, but it may be that somebody did. I'd be surprised if they didn't. Mike,
since
again.
You had that graphic back up there, would it have been socially possible for these gentlemen of the different tribes who have been sitting around listening to records?
That's a very good point. At this time, the different khans and the kingdoms were falling apart, and there was a great deal of enmity. So, in a nutshell, probably not. Yep.
Well, I wanted to add something to what the gentleman asked. We know from the memoirs of Gisbert that a lot of these records were shipped to the emirs and the khans of the period. So, there were already people that were listening to them. I would like to go back to Because nationalism came in. The Armenians, Pagrat is unknown because Pagrat was an internationalist. And they don't like internationalists. They prefer somebody who spoke and sang only in Armenian. Having said that, in my research, which directs mostly to Turkey and Greece, what I found, for example, is that a very famous Greek singer by the name of Aramis, that I'm really sure Mr. Nauk and others know very well, because his records on Polydipia are extremely rare, and they usually go for about $1,000 each. Aramis is considered in Greece even now as an unacceptable singer, because he was internationalist, he was in Paris, he was singing Greek and Turkish songs of the period in a way that was westernized, and that was unacceptable. It's a very interesting commentary that you made, and it's very unfortunate. I have worked a little bit with records of Bagrat.
Really?
I think the man was, yes, the man was quite well known. By the way, you know that the name Bagrat is a well-known name in that district, and there were kings by that name.
Yep.
And for $12 you can have 20 of those. Is there a similar recording to CDs of records?
Well, I'm glad you asked. There is one, and there will be a second. It's compiled and annotated by myself on the Topic record label. It's called Before the Revolution. It came out a couple of years ago, actually, and it got quite well reviewed. And it had quite a few of these images and some other unpublished photographs and bits and pieces. And it's all from the 1909 field trip. It's basically following the one guy eastwards. Do we need one more?
One more.
Sorry, this gentleman. It's a very good question. I don't believe they were, because I don't think there was a sufficient migration westwards to justify selling them. I imagine if there was a market for them, if anyone wanted them, perhaps, I don't know, when the French-Armenian diaspora, perhaps that was after 1915, there may have been. There's none documented that I've seen, and I have no real idea why we have these 50 records. I know that 10 of them came to us from the daughter of a journalist from the time, M. Phillips Price, who was an adventurer and a journalist and a later politician, who was writing for the Manchester Guardian as their Russian correspondent in 1917. And he must have picked these records up roughly at that time and brought them back. But the rest of them, we don't really know why they came to us. But I suspect very few of them made it to Western Europe. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Okay, before everybody takes off, two things. One, those of you who are going to be doing the ARSC editorial journal board meeting, if you could meet back there in the corner, then we will head back to lunch. And then Kurt also has an announcement.
Okay, we ran a little bit over this morning, but that's not too bad because you're not due back here until 1:30. A couple of things. I do now have the record convention tickets available at the registration desk. They're plenty of them, enough to go around. You needn't run right out right now to beat a path there. The other thing is that at 7 o'clock tonight over here in this room, Radisson 3, we will have a demonstration of the Archaeophone and the ELP laser turntable. We will then start the 8 o'clock collectors meeting in the Plaza Club room upstairs after that. Okay. This afternoon, we're dividing up into two tracks, as you've probably seen in your program. This room will be track one. Over here in Travis 3 will be track two. You can pick either room, and you're not obligated to stay in that room throughout the afternoon. Move back and forth to hear whichever presentations appeal to you. I think that's it. Thank you very much.
I wish I could have heard your talk. I had to go get dang tickets. And-